That's the big bell at Eiheiji Monastery in Japan back in 1959, welcoming you to a Cuke Audio Podcast chat. I'm DC, the Poobah of Cuke Archives and Cuke Audio, and today we have a conversation with Paul Shippey, who practiced with Shindu Suzuki and Chogyam Trungpa, and who has done a great deal more. I always visit him when I'm in Crestone, Colorado, and he's always got something new going on to tell me about, and new additions to his impressive hand-built home. He founded the Crestone Solar School, and his home is a good demonstration model for all things alternative. We had a long talk a few days ago. I'll share some of that with you, in which he tells a way-seeking mind story, which includes the story that Peter Schneider told last week about how Paul came to Tassajara, and Peter got it just right, using the exact wording that Paul used in his account of it. I'm going to mention a few things here so I don't break up his delivery, which I'm still going to do a few times to make excellent, historically significant points. When he says he wrote to Ivan about going to Tassajara, he didn't know Ivan then. He wrote to Zen Center, and Ivan Rand was the secretary who responded to his letter. His roommate in his fourth practice period, Van, is Van Voorhees, now an ordained monk in the Tibetan tradition. Julie Runk is Jane Schneider's sister. Jane was Jane Runk back then. Okay, here goes, dialing Paul Shippey.
Hello?
Paul.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, hear you great. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Good.
How are you?
Okay. You still living in Crestone in the same house?
Exactly. Yes, I am.
That's great.
I just spent a few months putting in a white oak floor upstairs. Hard work. Like, picture of white oak, beautiful grain, a planks 5 inches wide, tongue and groove, 3/4 inch thick, and then I had to buy a few tools to really do the job, but it's just about almost 98% finished.
Your house is the bottom is, what do you call it, rammed earth?
Yes.
And you have, you know, living in Crestone at about 8,500 feet or what?
Yes, that's right.
And
pretty close.
You know, it gets real cold. You have those heated floors.
That's right. From the solar panels on the roof produce hot water, warm water that's pumped through the floor every day.
And where does the electricity come for the pump?
I think it comes from coal and gas.
Uh-huh. It's from the grid.
It's from the grid.
Right.
And speaking of the grid, I just wrote a really nice article published as a feature article in the Crestone Eagle newspaper.
Yeah.
Title of it is, Community Solar Microgrids. We've been researching, and I've been researching, and with a small team here, we were applying for a large $3 or $4 million DOE Department of Energy grant to build a large array so we could have power if the grid goes down, and otherwise we would sell the power that we make
from
this large array into the grid. It's that
right.
simple. But I'll send you this article I wrote in order to educate the community, because we thought we were going to win that grant, but they discouraged us from doing the final full application because the Department of Energy is looking for a larger, 10 times the size of our community to do the experiment on, because it's all new technology and new stuff, you know.
Uh-huh. Try the Bill Gates people.
Yeah, I could try them. We're still looking.
I wanted to ask you one thing. On a recent podcast, we had Peter Schneider, and he was talking about early days coming to Zen Center, and he talked about living with you in the Hate. You remember that?
Living with me in the Hate.
Yeah.
I don't know about that.
Yeah, you all lived together in the Hate for a few months.
Oh, yeah, that was early on.
That's what I said.
Way early. That was before the Hate even got started.
Oh, that's right. Well, you were in the Haight-Ashbury area.
Yeah, David McCain and Peter and his brother and...
His brother, Gig?
Jigs. Yeah, his brother, Jigs, and David McCain and Richard Beauvais was there. Well, David McCain and Jigs and I and Richard Beauvais, a couple other people, Richard Beauvais, who you probably never met. He was my best friend, actually, through college. And who else? Peter. Oh, in college, Peter Schneider went to a different college nearby. He went to Springfield Tech, which is in Massachusetts. Some kind of university called Springfield Tech.
Mm-hmm.
He became a chemical major. Chemical engineering or chemistry, one of those.
Mm-hmm.
It's just up the road from where we went to college.
Mm.
Just over the line into Massachusetts.
Mm. And all right, so you all were living there. So you knew Peter because of Jigs.
Yeah, because Peter would come and visit us at University of Connecticut.
Ah, there we go. Okay, so you all were living there. Anyway, Peter mentioned that, right?
It was the best time of my life because of the quality of friends.
Oh.
Absolutely the best time. Second only to maybe high school, which was another best time in my life.
Oh, that's great. You were at Tassajara. Then when you came in let me guess, 69?
Into Tassajara, yeah, but in 68 is when I first met Suzuki Roshi.
Ah.
And I was sick with hepatitis at the time, and I was living in this apartment with these two. I was an actor. I was in the acting scene. I was in a lot of plays in San Francisco through my mid-20s. And improvisational theater, street theater, protesting Vietnam in New York and San Francisco, classical theater, improvisational theater, all kinds of avant-garde theater. I was in many different plays. In New York City, it was the Pageant Players. We had a flatbed truck, and we'd drive into these neighborhoods on weekends, and we would have get the instruments and the drums down on the sidewalk, and the actors would be up on the flatbed truck. And I played a general in the American Army. In San Francisco, there was not a name, but it was. You ever heard of Saul Landau?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. Well, his wife Nina was a very close friend of mine, and she was the director of this. And we would make up our own plays about the Vietnam War. And you know, Country Joe and the Fish.
Of course.
Well, Joe McDonald, the head of that, was part of our acting team. He was one of the actors. He actually showed me how to play the kazoo.
Oh, that's neat. Was and Peter Coyote, you knew
no,
him.
No, this is. I was totally separate from anything Peter Coyote was involved in. I knew him, but I was never in the meme troupe because my ex-wife was partnering with Ronnie Davis, and he didn't want me around.
Oh.
That was, I see. Because of that, I didn't get into the meme troupe. So Peter and I went different ways, even though we knew each other.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
Like, I never took drugs with Peter Coyote, and I dropped out of, you know, the acting scene and also anything to do with the Haight-Ashbury, and landed sort of in the lap of Suzuki Roshi. Because I was really sick, and I was disillusioned with everything I'd ever done, including college and science and art. I was just done with all of that. It didn't make any more sense to me. And when I landed on the cushion, that's when I decided I found my way.
Hey, that's good.
I'm not kidding.
Yeah.
When I first laid out these two, I was living in a house in Haight-Ashbury with these two ladies in 1968, two acting ladies from the Actors Workshop. That was a company one of the companies that I acted with. And I was living with them, and I was very sick with hepatitis. They told me one night, we're going to see this Zen master named Suzuki Roshi give a talk on a Christmas Eve or something like that. One of those, it was near Christmas. And they said, do you want to go? And I said, sure. So I went, we got there early. I sat in the front row upstairs, and there was a shrine, and there was this guy sitting on the stage with his back to us, dressed in brown with a bald head. And next to him was a big gong. And I thought it was the most amazing thing, the stillness of him. And then the gong rang, and he got up and he gave a lecture, and I never saw anybody laugh so hard in my life. So the contrast between the stillness and the laughter and expressiveness of his talk, whatever he was talking about, it didn't matter. It wasn't about the words. It was about his being. And years later, I realized that it was that encounter that made me follow Zen Buddhism, because he was like the whatever he had, I had been looking for that all my life, and I didn't really know it. I didn't find it in science. I didn't find it in sports. I didn't find it in acting or any other art form. And I didn't find it in drugs either. But I found it when I saw him. It didn't hit me until many years later that that's what happened. That's what happened. So I went back home. My brother sent me a one-way ticket for Christmas. And I went home, and I got really sick, and I stayed at home.
Home was where?
In Meriden, Connecticut, where I went to high school.
Yeah.
And so my parents took care of me, and I recovered, and my father thought it was something wrong. I had long hair and an earring, and he sent me over to this psychiatric, it used to be a TB sanitarium, but they turned it into a mental hospital for the worst mental cases.
Wait a minute. I want you to repeat that. I didn't understand it. Somebody sent you, did you say your father?
Yeah, my father. He thought something was wrong with me. I come back after 5 years away, 6 years away, with long hair and an earring and being sick. So he thought something was wrong with me mentally.
Oh, I see. All right, I got it.
So he wanted me to go see the chief psychiatrist at this mental hospital in Connecticut, in Meriden. This hospital was an experimental unlocked wards with patients that were transferred from an old hospital called Norwich, Connecticut, where they beat it was, you know, one of those typical old fashioned mental hospitals where they beat the inmates. And I mean, it was just terrible. So they transferred some of them over to this hospital and tried unlocked wards. And I went, my father's family to go see the chief psychiatrist. After talking to him for an hour, he offered me a job as a psychiatric aide.
Huh?
So I worked there for a year.
And during
that time, I was practicing meditation every day, every evening. And I even was so desperate to be able to sit without moving that I would smoke a joint before I started. It was the only way I could really get into a 20-minute meditation that without disturbances, smoke a joint first. After a year of that, I moved back to New York City. And continued meditating with some Zen teachers there.
What Zen teachers there?
What's his name?
Edo Shimano?
Edo, yeah, Shimano, right.
All right.
Studied, went to his Zendo, studied with him.
New York Zen Studies.
Yeah, exactly. And then one day I went to a lecture in North in Greenwich Village. I lived in the East Village, and so I went over to the West Village, and there was a guy there named Geshe Sopa. I saw it in the Village Voice. He was going to give a talk on Buddhism. So I went over there, and Geshe Sopa was kind of one of those scholarly types, and he had actually a professorship at the University of Wisconsin. So he was in New York City giving a talk, and I went up to him later, and I said, well, are there any Tibetans around here? And I had never met a Tibetan before in my life. And he said, in New Jersey, there is a house where some Tibetan monks live. It's like a seminary or something. And so I got directions, and I drove my little Volkswagen over there on the next Sunday and spent the whole day there. And there was a guy there, a white guy. The Tibetan monks that were living there in robes, they didn't have much to say because they couldn't speak English. But I hung out with them, had some meal with them. And then I found myself standing in a doorway, and this white guy was standing in this doorway with me. And I asked, it turns out this white guy actually was Jeffrey Hopkins, who has written many books about meditation, a very famous scholar. But he was very young at the time. I mean, he was just getting started. But I asked him this very crucial question, which was bothering me a lot. And I didn't know why I was sitting. I had a lot of questions in life. So I turned to him and I said, listen, I need to ask you a question. I'm trying to figure out why I sit. Can you help me find an answer for that? And he says, well, there may not be a real big answer to that. But he says, how do you feel after you sit or while you're sitting? Do you like it? What happens to you? I said, well, actually, I do like it for a variety of reasons. He said, well, just let that motivation of that sitting motivate you to sit the next day and just go from one sitting to the next. Never mind trying to figure out some big philosophical answer to why you're sitting.
Good.
Just go. Isn't that nice?
Good. Yeah.
That was fantastic.
Yeah.
So then, now I got to tell you this now. I got to, because it has to do with Peter Schneider. Soon after that, I was in my apartment in the East Village on a weekend. I was reading the Village Voice. And all of a sudden, I saw on page 32 or something, a picture of Peter Schneider. And it said he was the director of the Tassajara Zen Mountain Center. And I said, well, shit, if he can do it, I can do it. So I immediately wrote to Yvonne and I applied for the next training period.
He wrote to Zen Center. Yvonne Rand answered it, and that's how he and Yvonne became acquainted.
And I quit my job in the New York City, which was a social worker in the Brooklyn and Bedford-Stuyvesant, the poorest, most violence-ridden neighborhood in New York, where I was a caseworker for the New York Department of Social Services. And I quit my job and I spent the summer up in Maine. And then I headed out west with my girlfriend in my truck and landed in San Francisco, sold my motorcycle to raise the money for the training period at Tassajara. And then that would be in the fall of 1969.
Yeah.
And then, so I paid the money and I became a student, and Peter was there just as it said in the Village Voice, being the director, and where I had thought, if he can do it, I can do it. That's exactly what I thought. And I said, I'm going to do it. So I wanted to deepen my meditation. Every day after work, I would come home and sit in my apartment in front of the fireplace and put a stick of incense in a bowl and sit for as long as it took for that incense to burn down.
Oh, yeah, that's traditional.
Yeah, I did that every day. And if somebody happened to be in my apartment at the time, like a friend or a girlfriend or whatever, I would tell them, please, I want you to leave while I'm doing this sitting because I don't want to be bothered. So So I'd make them leave while I do it, while I was sat. Every day after I'd come home from work from Brooklyn subway, I would go upstairs and start and do this before having dinner. I just tell them to leave because I could, I already knew they didn't have any interest, but I guess it would have been very generous of me to ask them to join, to see if they wanted to join me. But I didn't even think of that, actually. I wasn't very awake in those days.
Oh, well, but still pretty good.
But then I read this. then I read this book. I was in that apartment. I read this book by Eiken Roshi. No. What's the one in Rochester, New York, the Zen master
Kapler,
who died?
Kapler, you read Three Pillars of Zen.
I read Three Pillars of Zen. And when I closed the last page, I got on the phone and I called him. And he answered the phone. Couldn't believe it. I said, I want to talk to this guy because I'm not sure I like what I read in this book. I'm not sure if that's for me. Let me talk to this guy and see what he's about. So I called him up and he answered the phone, actually. And I had a chat with him for about half an hour. And at the end of the half an hour, I decided he's not my cup of tea, that guy, Philip Kapler. He's not going to be my teacher. And so I continued with my plan to enroll at the Tassajara Zen Mountain Center for the fall of 69 training period. So, I sold my motorcycle, which I had left in San Francisco in the company of somebody in Marin, I forget who, and I got it back and I sold it. So I was able to go. And during that, I was in the back of a dump truck shoveling manure onto the garden. And I looked at my partner there who was helping me. I says to him, this gets better every day, doesn't it? So I was actually liking quite a bit. And I had this experience there where I was so overwhelmed by this experience sitting that I had to go and talk to Suzuki Roshi about it. And the experience was that in the period before lunch every day, we had just finished that period before lunch and we had turned around and we had our Ariyoki bowls out on the wood in front of us. And we were waiting for the food to be served. And I was just kind of looking at the floor and I saw this spot of sunlight on the floor coming through some window. And as I looked at that spot of sunlight, all of a sudden something happened to me. Like, it's like my hair stood up on end and I had this really strong realization that that it's always now. That's how it came to me. The words, I had this powerful interior experience that it's always now. It's not about past and future, it's always now. And my whole being lit up. I mean, my hair stood on end. I swear, it was like the shiver went through me. And I said to myself, I have to go ask Suzuki Roshi about this. So I asked Peter if I could get a meeting because Suzuki Roshi was there the whole time, as you know, because you were there.
No, I wasn't. I was in Monterey studying Japanese. That's the first practice period I missed.
But then you came back.
Yeah, I was just gone that practice. I was gone in half the summer in that practice period, and then I was back in 70.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, very good. So I had this amazing experience of it, that it's always now. There is no past and future. It's just always now. And you better wake up to that because that's what the reality is. It's always now. So I went to see Suzuki Roshi and I sat down in his cold cabin. He has hibachi going. And I asked him, I said, what about that experience? I said, is that an enlightenment experience? And he said, yes. And so I said, well, what about you? Are you like that all the time? Or how does that work for you? And he said, well, it's kind of like sometimes I just hear a bird sing. And he meant that he has that same experience. Sometimes if a bird just sings spontaneously, he'll have that experience of nowness. Mm-hmm. So that's all. He didn't get too fussy about it or philosophical. He just gave me a bird singing, wakes him up.
Mm.
So I had gone there because I wanted to learn how to meditate. Because even though I had been meditating every day in the mental hospital and in New York City, I wanted to learn deeper. So I applied for the next training period. And of course, not being paid, I didn't have any money. So the next three training periods, I went, they gave me a scholarship because I worked in the shop and took care of the shop. So I never had to pay again. But I went the next three training periods.
If somebody was a mechanic, we would waive all rigid rules of what the requirements to stay were. We let a biker stay.
He was there a few months, and he wasn't a student.
Go on.
Yeah, I was a good mechanic. I take after my father. I was trained as an engineer in college, so I mean, I had those kind of skills. I kept coming back. I didn't stay in the summer because when somebody said the razor's edge gets a little dull in the summer, that kind of turned me off. And I decided to go out traveling to New Mexico and visit communes and see the other side of the hippie life out of the city. The guys in Libre, yeah, and all of that in Southern Colorado and New Mexico.
So oh, yeah.
You know, traveled around and got, yeah, to make a lot of good friends over there. Then I would go back to San Francisco and get into the next training period.
Again, because he's a mechanic. Normally a student would have to stay in the summer to pay for a practice period. Personally, I loved the summers. I still do.
So then I went through two training periods. Then the last training period, the fourth training period, you remember Van? Yeah. Okay. He was my
Van,
roommate.
Yeah.
And so he came back after the winter break. This would have been in 71 in the spring, in the winter. Peter Schneider was still there, and Jane, of course. I was pretty happy there, actually. I didn't worry about too much. I just enjoyed the meditation. I tell you what, when I first went there, I didn't believe I could get up at 4 o'clock in the morning. I said, I cannot do this. I cannot do this. So I finally resolved my negativity about that by telling myself this, and I mean it. I freely told myself that, okay, Paul, if you don't get up, nobody will get up. Nobody's going to get up unless you get up. That's how I fooled myself into getting up.
Good.
I was doing it for the whole group.
Good.
I was carrying the whole group, and that way I was able to get up and not worry about myself. Yeah, it was kind of neat.
Good.
So Van comes along, and in 1971 in January when we reconvened at Tassajara, and I'm sitting there on the ground in the sun, and he walks by me, and he says, Paul, I have these tapes from Chogyam Trungpa. You want to hear some? And I said, no, I'm really not interested. And in the break, I had come back and spent some time in the city before we went down to Tassajara. And Trungpa gave a large community talk there. You might have been there. It would be in Christmas, between 70 and 71, the Christmas, the New Year in that time. And he gave this talk and the Buddha Hall in the city center was packed with people. I came sort of from where I was staying next door. I think I was staying in that house next door where Katagiri stayed. And I came down, I came into the thing. I couldn't get into the room. I had to sit on the threshold of the doors, the French doors. So I sat there, and he said, he's way up on the raised platform at the other end of the room. One thing I remember distinctly, I had a question. People were raising their hands and asking questions. I was kind of listening. I wasn't too interested in what was going on, really. Nothing was really moving to me at all. But I did think of this question that I would have. So I raised my hand, and I was called on by him, and I don't remember the question, and I don't remember the answer. What I do remember, and a lot of people say this about Trungpa, is that when I asked that question, I felt like he was talking directly to me, as if we were just sitting in a room. It was that intimate, his answer. And he does that with everybody. So I experienced that part of him. But I didn't get, attracted or wanting to study with him or anything. So I just went on my way, went back to Tassajara, and then Van comes along with these tapes, the audio tapes. He says, Paul, you want to hear some of these tapes? I said, no, I'm not interested. So one day, I happened to be in his room because we had adjoining rooms, and I happened to walk through his room, and I saw on the desk, on his desk, a tape laying there with the title, The Six Paramitas. And I had been studying in the study hall before every morning these books, which were always almost always about Tibetan Buddhism, the life and teachings of Naropa, or the foundations of Tibetan mysticism by Lama Govinda, these books I was reading every day. And so I was also searching in the library for other books. And I saw these books on six paramitas that I really thought were kind of interesting. But reading them was kind of difficult. It was like seeing through a glass darkly. They were like English translations of Japanese translations of Chinese, sort of like, and the sort of the whole thing gets lost in the syntax. But still, something came through that I really liked. And when I saw this tape on his desk, I said, I'm going to listen to that tape. So the next morning, instead of going to study hall after sitting, I came back to my cabin, and I had Julie Runk had loaned me a tape recorder with batteries so I could play it.
Julie Runk, far out.
Yeah. So I sat there listening in the pre-dawn darkness of the cabin to this Tibetan guy named Chogyam Trungpa talk about the six paramitas. And meanwhile, somebody started tapping me on the shoulder.
That was the Tenkin who takes attendance, checks up on people that aren't where they're supposed to be, and brings food to the sick. They don't really have enforcement powers.
And I felt kind of a little bit annoyed. And they said, Paul, you have to come to study hall. I said, I am in study hall. No, you're not. You have to come in the study hall with everyone else. I said, look, I'm not going. I have to listen to this tape, and that's going to be my study for today. Said, okay, Paul. So whoever that was left me alone, and I listened to this tape, and I was completely blown away by Trungpa's rendition or explanation of the six paramitas.
Can you tell us what the six paramitas are?
Yes. Six paramitas are sort of a guide for meditators in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, at least. And the first one, they build one on after the other. So the first one is Dana Paramita, which means generosity. Dana, D-A-N-A, the Sanskrit. And so the first one is generosity. If you don't have generosity, you cannot make much progress on the path, is the idea. Second one is Shila Paramita. And paramita means beyond. So these are disciplines beyond the normal rational mind. And so the second one is Shila Paramita, and it means discipline. Or some people say morality. So it's kind of discipline, morality, like doing the right thing to get to be able to follow the Dharma. And then the third one is Shanti Paramita, which is translated as patience. Very profound practice, patience, because most of us are speedy, and patience cuts through that and helps you wake up. And then the fourth one is Virya Paramita, and that means exertion or effort. Trungpa liked to translate it as exertion, because it takes work to be able to sit still. And then the fifth one is samadhi, which is meditation. So then the last one is prajna paramita, which is the name of the prajna paramita sutra. And prajna is translated as penetrating insight that sees the truth or sees what is and cuts through.
our wisdom.
It's sometimes translated as wisdom, but wisdom is kind of tricky because, yeah, it is wisdom. It's prajna is what cuts through a confused mind in order to see emptiness. So those are the six paramitas. And that's like a path you can follow or a developmental schema that, yeah, like that. So that's what they are.
Yeah.
So he was explaining these. And he was explaining these in this tape. Like, and when he came to talk about what a bodhisattva is, he said a bodhisattva is someone who can do something for everybody. Like, if somebody wants to cross the water, he'll be a boat, or she'll be a boat. If somebody wants to go on a highway, he'll be a bridge. And if somebody wants to, you know, like that, they'll just be, in other words, approaching towards this word that has bugged me since I read it in a book when I was 13. And this word is called selflessness. And I have always been totally magnetized by this word ever since I read it. I never forget that time when I was reading that book when I was 13. This word selflessness came up, and it just...
Where were you when you read it?
I was at home with my parents in Meriden, Connecticut, or maybe we lived in Providence, Rhode Island. I lived in Providence, Rhode Island until the middle of ninth grade, and then we moved to Meriden, Connecticut, because my father got a different job. It was only a few hours away, but, you know, it was a long way. So Connecticut, yeah.
Yeah.
So so that was interesting, being hung up on this word, selflessness. What does this mean? So I guess I've spent my whole life trying to find out what the answer to that question that I asked when I was 13. What does selflessness mean? So then... So those are the six parameters leading to the fruition, according to Tibetan Buddhism, fruition of practice and the enlightenment and the results of Dharma practice is wisdom and compassion, like two wings of a bird. That you cannot fly, the bird cannot fly without two wings, and you cannot fly without having both wisdom and compassion. Wisdom, meaning the prajna, or the insight that sees emptiness, that sees the insubstantiality of all things, sees no self, et cetera, like that. So those are the, you know, the fruition aspects. And the funny thing is that after me traveling half a lifetime through the Tibetan canon, to the Tibetan teachings, through scholarly study, to meditation, retreats, whatever, and going into Vajrayana, what you wind up with at the end is Dzogchen. It comes out to be where you started in Tazahara with just sitting. It's amazing. It's amazing. Totally.
Yeah. Hey, I want to bring something up. Your emails have the, in the signature at the bottom, have the quote, kindness is more important than wisdom, and the recognition of that is the beginning of wisdom, Theodore Rubin. And that's another way of saying you need two wings.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. Nice of you to notice that. So anyway, that's some of the highlights of my Buddhist life, Buddhist experience. I still sit every day. Further and further, it just gets simpler and simpler until this quality of Dzogchen and seeing what is and just relaxing and letting go and having a spacious but very alert mind and being is what the fruition is. And that's what I love. I actually love that. It's the least painful way of living. In fact, it's not painful at all. It's pleasurable.
Yeah, that's an excellent sort of a way-seeking mind story. There's more from Paul, and I will put it up maybe as a separate podcast in a couple of days. We'll see. Pretty interesting stuff, huh? You can learn more about Paul Shippey by going to kyuk.com. And in the site search box, write Shippey, S-H-I-P-P-E-E. And I have this link there, but you can get his articles. He's written a lot of articles for the Crestone Eagle. Just write Crestone Eagle. It's crestoneeagle.com. And you'll see them there. He mentions the one here about solar microgrids explained. He talks about visiting a Buddhist monastery in New Jersey back in, before he came to Tassahara, so in 68, or 69, it was probably 69. So I've heard of that place. You know, I was trying to figure out whether to call Tassahara the first Buddhist monastery in the Western world or not. I stick with the first Zen Buddhist monastery. And there even were some Zen Buddhist communities that were small and had Japanese monks, or at least one I can think of. But there was a early Buddhist monastery in New Jersey, and it was founded, here I'll read it. The first Tibetan Buddhist Lama to have American students, Geshe Ngawang Wangyal, a Kalm Mongolian of the Gelug lineage, who came to the United States in 1955 and founded the Lamaist Buddhist Monastery of America in New Jersey in 1958. Among his students were the future Western scholars Robert Thurman, Jeffrey Hopkins, Alexander Berzin, and Anne C. Klein. Other arrivals included Dejung Rinpoche, a Sakya Lama who settled in Seattle in 1960, and Tartang Tulku Rinpoche, the first Nyingma teacher in America who arrived in the U.S. in 1968 and established the Tibetan Nyingma Meditation Center in Berkeley, California in 1969. That brings us to the end of Act 1 of Chat with Paul Shippey. Now, there's going to be a brief intermission after the bell. Just hit pause and go get yourself some popcorn or whatever you fancy. When you come back, just unpause, and we'll be here waiting to hit the bell to begin Act 2. Of Chat with Paul Shippey. After you heard that tape, that was in the winter spring practice
yes.
period, 71, did you go start studying with Trungpa then?
Well, I sat down and wrote him a letter. I sat down one day at Tassahara in the spring and wrote him a letter. And what I said in the letter was essentially was this, a question. Because I was getting a little bit not disenchanted with Zen or with Buddhism, but with the Sangha, because I didn't feel people were warm and weren't manifesting the way the Dharma was telling you you're supposed to manifest. And so I was getting kind of a little bit questioning, you know, and what the Sangha is all about.
Yeah.
And so I wrote him a letter, and I said, I've been practicing Zen Buddhism for 2 years now, maybe 3 years, actually. Actually, by that time, it was 4 years since I first met Suzuki Roshi and then went away to home when I was sick and then got the job at the, yeah, all of that. So it's been four yeah. years. And I said, I've been practicing Zen Buddhism and I've been at the monastery here for a while. And I just wonder, you know, I've listened to your tapes, your talks about Tibetan Buddhism, and I've read Gelama Govinda's amazing stories. And I just wonder if I feel attracted to Tibetan Buddhism because it's more philosophy connected with the practice that you can sort of, if you're an intellectual like me, you can dig your teeth into that intellectual part and not get, you know, too hung up on it. You just still practice your meditation. And I said, well, do you think it's reasonable for an American who's been practicing Zen Buddhism to then switch over to Tibetan Buddhism? That's the exact question I asked him. And I mailed off the letter, and this was already coming toward the end of the training period. And I knew that having been a Zen Buddhist practitioner for 4 years now, 2 years at Tassajara, that I felt like I was going to be obligated in my own mind that I have to become a priest. I can't just go on sucking off the teachings, and I have to start giving back something. I was going to become a priest. Mm-hmm. But when I drove my truck through that arch on the last day of the training period after the session, I drove my truck. When I crossed under that arch at the entrance and exit of Tassajara, I had this eerie feeling that I was never coming back. I didn't know why anything. I just had this intuitive sense that it just came over me like a rain, that I'm not going to come back. Something's going to change. So I had heard from, what's his name? I can't think of his, maybe I'll think of his name, in San Francisco, a friend of mine, who told me that Trungpa was coming to the West Coast, and he was going to give a talk in Oakland about 2 weeks after this training period ended. So I was determined to go to that talk.
Mm-hmm.
And I never received any answer from him in terms of anything in the mail from Trungpa. But I went to the talk. It was at a high school gymnasium in Oakland, California. And I'm sure you know this person I'm thinking of. He was more like a philosopher guy. I've knew him ever since my earliest days in San Francisco in the early 60s. I'll think of his name in a minute. It almost came to me. Anyway, he told me that, that where and when. And then I hooked up with some other people in San Francisco around that scene that he knew. Oh, Henry Schaefer is his name.
Oh, Henry, certainly.
Yeah. So Henry Schaefer told me that Trungpa was coming. And then Henry had some friends, and I sort of slept on the floor in Henry's apartment until the time of the talk in Oakland. So then I went over there, and I got over there early, and I sat right in the front row, right in the middle. And then I saw this guy come out on the stage. I had seen him before, but, you know, it wasn't such a big deal. And he gave this talk. And immediately at the end of the talk, I jumped up and I went up to the stage and I looked up at him sitting in a chair under the basketball hoop, actually. And I asked him, I said, did you get my letter? And I don't remember what he said. He said, what did it say? I said, well, I was asking you if it was a good thing or reasonable for a Zen student to then become involved in the Tibetan Buddhist practices and teachings. And he said, well, what do you want? I said, he said, why don't you, I'm staying in Berkeley at Sam Burkle's house, and somebody gave me the address, and he said, you should come over and talk to me, and we can talk then, because other people were wanting to talk to him at this gymnasium. So a few days later, I went over there and we sat on the back porch, me and him, and I told him, I said, well, you know, it's not that I'm disappointed in Zen, but I'm not feeling that comfortable with the Sangha, with the people. They seem uptight and kind of cold to me. And I want something that's more friendly and more philosophically oriented, more explanations of the depths of the Dharma, which Tibetan Buddhism is really good at, by the way, turns out. I said, okay, I want to be your student. He said, okay. So then I became his student. And I got hooked up with him and Henry Schaefer and some other people. And we went over to the houseboat of Alan Watts one night with Trungpa. And Alan Watts was very drunk that night. But we sat in the houseboat, and they talked, and we talked, and everybody talked. And I lay on the floor in the back, and this Jewish girl had her feet on my belly giving me a massage while the talk was going on. And I hooked up with a coyote out in Olima, where he was living with other people, and I started going out there for the next month. And it turns out they were planning to have a caravan to leave California and go east, at least to Colorado, because some of us had already been to Colorado. We knew what Libre was, and we knew we had a destination. And I had a truck, and all these other people were fixing up trucks to travel, and we decided to have a caravan. And so we were in Forest Knolls, at a place called the Red House, and with what's his name, who passed away actually a few years ago, two brothers who had the psychedelic shop on Haight Street. It was their house, and there was a large community living in his house.
What's his name?
I'll think of it in a minute again. Maybe you don't know. Maybe you didn't go on the Haight when the psychedelic. Oh, Ron Thalen.
Ron Thalen. Yeah, of course I went to the Haight. I was there in 66 in the spring. That's when it all got started there.
You must have at some point seen the psychedelic shop.
Well, of course. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Ron and his brother ran that. Okay. So Ron had a house in Forest Knolls. Him and his wife actually owned this house. And it was red, and so they call it the Red House. It was in Forest Knolls. And Peter had just got evicted from Olima, the ranch where they had been living, where Peter convalesced from hepatitis. After the spring training period was over, I would go up and spend a few days there now and then in my truck. I was just kind of moving around and maybe stay in Bolinas for a while. And I decided I wanted to join this caravan because I thought California was getting way crowded. And I would at the same time I was living actually in the house next door again, where Kataguri lived, next to the city center. And I decided that instead of becoming a priest, in order to give back to the Zen Center from all that I had learned and all that I had benefited from being a part of the Zen Center, San Francisco Zen Center, that instead of giving back by being a priest, that I was going to opt for lay ordination, and I was going to sew a raksu under the tutorship of this Zen nun that was living there at the time. And she was teaching us how to sew a raksu, a Japanese woman.
Are you talking about Joshin-san, the young one, or are you talking about Yoshida Roshi, the older woman?
I think it was the younger one.
Oh, yeah. Joshin-san. She sewed me an okesa.
Uh-huh. Well, she taught me how to. She didn't sew mine. She taught me how to do it. And there was a few of us in that class, sewing class. That I figured that was going to be my way. I was going to stay there, stay put in San Francisco, right there in that house. And I was going to not leave until I finished this lay ordination thing and finish sewing this raksu. And I guess Suzuki Roshi or somebody had done the calligraphies inside to show the whole lineage.
Yeah, Suzuki Roshi did the calligraphy.
Right. And so that was the lineage. So I became a lay ordained, whatever you call it.
You became a lay ordained Soto Zen Buddhist. Well, I was in the earlier one in 1970, but I was at your ordination too. It was in August, I think.
I don't remember when it was, but we actually left in the caravan in July from the Red House.
Oh, then it was in July, huh? All right.
Yeah, it could have been in July, yeah. So I was, that was it. I was done with Zen Center. I mean, not done permanently, but I just had finished that obligation of giving something back, which was sewing the raksu. That was how I conceived of that. And so Tukpa was scheduled to give his first large 10-day seminar in Estes Park. It's actually in Allen's Park, Colorado, near Estes Park. And so I told these guys, including Coyote, I said, you know, I want to come on this caravan, but I'm going to peel off and attend this 10-day seminar in Boulder, I mean, in Colorado, in Allen's Park. So this was his Trungpa's first big 10-day seminar in America. And it was outdoor, it was indoors, but it was on a big grassy hill. People mostly hung out outside. And there was a huge number of people there. And, you know, Trungpa had only been in America for a year and a half maybe at this point. And this whole seminar filled up. And I was the first one to lead the caravan out of San Francisco because I kind of knew the roads. And I don't know why I ended up in the front leading it, but I kind of knew where I was going. And so we all went through. Coyote had this big wagon with the hoops over the top and a canvas and his welding tanks strapped to
it. I remember it. Yeah.
Yeah. And, yeah. And Peter Berg was there with his panel truck like mine, and he was a little bigger. And Judy, his wife, and Peter, and Coyote, and Eileen, his wife, mm-hmm. And their baby, who now lives in Park City, Utah. And she's a forensic psychologist, actually. Her name is Ariel. You remember Ariel?
Yeah, Ariel.
Right. Yeah. And so we all took off. There was maybe 10 or maybe a dozen or more trucks in this caravan, panel trucks and all kinds of weird looking things that hippies put together with big glass bubbles on the front and different things. So we wound our way out of California into Nevada, into the desert. We went to Pyramid Lake first, and then we went to other places. And actually, at one of our stops, I made this arrow. We were like playing Indians or something. I made this arrow to kind of maybe I could catch some fish with it in a stream. And Peter Coyote still has that arrow on his altar in his home. And every time I visit him, he said, Paul, this arrow is still here. And anyway, cool. So yeah. We kept going and we got to Boulder. Yeah, we got into Boulder, and right away, Peter got news that his father had died. And but I was riding with him when he got the news, and I said, "Are you going to go to the funeral?" And he said, "I don't think so." So he didn't go. He stayed with us. And so they camped out up on Gold Hill, which is a nice little mountain community above Boulder, about 20 minutes or so. And I stayed at the Allen's Park, and then I went into the town of Boulder to where Trungpa was staying, and I stayed at that house for a while. And one night, I knew where they were camped. The caravan was camped for me and waiting for me and this Chinese woman, Mei Ting, who traveled with me, she and I occupied my truck. And they were waiting for us to get, because she came to the Trungpa seminar also. And they were waiting up at a campsite, just hanging out, camping out, enjoying themselves above Boulder, and come down into Boulder, make some connections and see some old friends or whatever. And one day I said to Trungpa, I said, you know what? I want you to meet my friends. I'm on a caravan and we're traveling from California and we're heading to Southern Colorado. And we're stopped here because of the seminary that you just put on. And I want to bring you up to the camp and have you meet my friends up there. And he said, okay, yeah, we'll go. So when it came time to go, like in the late afternoon, we were going to go up there and have the dinner meal with them. We were heading out the door, and his wife all of a sudden stepped in. And she said, no, I don't want you to go. And I said, why not? She said, because I heard that those people have guns. And I'm afraid that Chogyam might get hurt. I said, no way. These people are my friends. But she prevailed, and she made him not come. So he never got to meet Peter Coyote, for one thing. And Peter Coyote never got to meet him. That would have been a wonderful evening if I could have got out of the house with him and up there. You know, he would have seen a part of America. He wouldn't. Well, he's, you know, he got around with a lot of hippies, so he knew the scene. But these were kind of extreme hippies in a way from California.
Yeah.
And
Yeah.
So we never did that. So then after a few more days, I joined up with the caravan again, and we headed down south to camp out in the Huerfano Valley and visit the communes there, Red Rockers, the all of which were from L.A., actually, and visit Libre, which were an artist community on the...
I know Libre, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And then further out was the Red Rockers, and then the other one was the AAA people. There were musicians and artists from... they were from L.A. They were the ones from L.A. So the three communes, Red Rockers, the AAA, and Libre, all in different parts of the valley, maybe 20 minutes ride apart. So we went there.
Southern, that's in southeast Colorado.
The south central.
South central?
Yeah, maybe a little bit east. Actually, I'm in south.
Yeah.
I'm in south central in Crestone. I think Libre is by the...
I think of you as the west. You're Crestone's sort of west. Well,
no, Durango.
You know, it's to the west of the Rockies, and Libre's to the east of the Rockies, right?
No, we're both in the Rockies, in different valleys.
Well, yeah, but they're on the east side, and you're on the west side.
Yes, of the Sangre de Cristo Mountains, yes.
Right.
They're on the east side. As the crow flies, they're only probably like 10 miles from here, 15 miles at the post.
Oh, come on.
Yeah,
oh,
no
come
kidding.
Come on. Really?
I've walked it. I've walked from there over the mountains down to here. I walked it. I know how far it is. Yeah.
I did not realize that.
Yeah, they're very close.
Long drive. It's a long drive.
Yeah, well, you have to go all the way around. Yeah, it's about, let's see, it's 1 hour, 2 hour, 2.5 hours to get from here to Libre if you go around. So, but by the crow flies, 10 miles, 20 miles, I don't know, certainly less than 20 miles.
Wow.
So you have the Huerfano Valley over there, and then on this side of the Sangre de Cristos, you have the San Luis Valley. Then we split up down there in the valley, in Huerfano Valley. We were camped at a vacant ranch area near Libre, and we took good care of everything, and people came to stay with us. We had campfires, and we painted the walls of the house we were staying in. We cleaned up. Peter Coyote was big on that. Got everybody to work to kind of give back in the same way by doing something good for the place that hosted us in a vacant adobe house, a big adobe house. So then we left, and the moon is rising just now over the mountain here. By the way, so Peter, his father had died, and he did not go to the funeral. And his mother was wanting to see him, and he wanted to go and see what's up with the father's estate. And it turns out that his father's estate died in worse than bankruptcy, owed money, lots of money. So his father, as much of as a big Wall Street player and a drug addict he was, popping secondols and all kinds of pills, as he tells in the Sleeping Where I Fall book, his father was a failure, financial failure. So Peter never, you know, got a penny. They had to sell the farm that was in the Poconos in Pennsylvania, where he grew up in summer times, to pay off the debts and sell the house in New Jersey. And the mother was totally embarrassed. She had to sell her silverware and everything. So I was there at the house when all that was going on. We stayed at the farm in the Poconos before it was sold. And Peter was mourning and grieving the loss of his father. He had that full photograph of him always by the table when we sat around in the evenings. And it was a grieving time. And I had been putting together poems that I had written. And I had always wanted to go to Provincetown. So I didn't really want to stay there. I stayed there for about maybe 2 weeks, 3 weeks at the most. And it was starting to get cold. And I decided that I was going to produce a long-term dream, which is go to Provincetown, Massachusetts, and make this book of poetry that I had been collecting and writing and turn it into a book of some kind. So I went there and I spent the winter in Provincetown and did that and made that book of poems. And a drawing that Peter Coyote had made of a turtle, like Turtle Island, I used as the cover photograph or the cover of picture. So we connected like that. And then after that winter.
Wait a minute. Wait. What did you call the book?
Every Day.
Mm-hmm. Is it available now?
Well, it was self-published, and I never tried to get it published in any bigger way. I sent a bunch of copies.
I'll publish it.
Well, I'll have to send you a copy.
Yeah, all right.
You want me to?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Hey, I want to go back to one thing. Do you remember a group in Colorado of hippies called the Pygmies?
Of course. They were the ones who the first, that's where Trungpa got his first strong taste of hippies, living on the road, so to speak.
Right.
Yeah. And the Pygmies.
They tried to study with him, but it was, they were too loose, I think.
No, they did study with him for quite a while. And some of them are still,
oh, really?
And some of them are still studying with him.
Oh, that's good to hear.
Oh, yeah.
I'd heard that differently. All right, good.
No, the Pygmies, when I was there that summer with the caravan, the news was that Trungpa decided that he wanted to make Boulder his home base, because up until then he'd been traveling around, and there was a small farm that he'd been given in Vermont that was called the Tail of the Tiger at the time. Now it's called Karma Choling, and it's still there, thriving away. And so he decided he wanted to stay in Boulder because it reminded him of Tibet because of the mountains, the Colorado mountains.
Right.
So he said, we need to have a retreat center that I would like to purchase, and I would like it to be not too much further than 2 hours from Boulder. So that became the Rocky Mountain Dharma Center, which is now called the Shambhala Mountain Center. And the Pygmies, see, in the summertime, before it was even purchased, with a little group of people, when I was there with the caravan, and we, not the caravan people, but some other people, went up to look at the land. It's only a 2-hour drive. So we went up one day, and it was uninhabited, had wild horses running all over the place, and it had never been inhabited. And it was 40 acres, and this guy who had an inheritance from his mother decided he was going to put up the $40,000 that it took to buy it. And so he did, and we acquired it. And the Pygmies, this would have been in like October or even November, very close to winter. Oh, so that had been 1972. That
right.
Well, the end of 71 was when it was actually purchased. In like October or November. Could even have been September, but winter was coming. And the Pygmies, a group of maybe, I don't know, 20 people, which mm-hmm. I became friends with every one of them later, they decided that, you know, they were living out in the plains, maybe 5 to 10 miles east of Boulder on some vacant lot. And In school, it was start getting cold. They had to come up from New Orleans where it was warm. And they wanted to be students of Trungpa. So he said, they asked if they could go up and live on this land through the winter and build little houses to live in. So they were the first occupants. And they occupied the land, built some shacks and a larger building so they could work on cars and trucks. And each one built some kind of plywood shack and got through the winter. And I arrived there from Provincetown with Mary, the mother of my daughter, Jennifer, in that spring of 72. Well, it was June by the time I got there, and I just jumped right in and started living there and helping with the building, and there were building structures, and I was stayed in a tent up until winter, and then moved into a dome that somebody gave me there, a little dome that they had built, and we spent the winter in that dome, Mary and myself, and that's where my daughter was conceived, right in that dome, in the middle of winter, yeah. And so that was the start of Rocky Mountain Dharma Center, the retreat center and program center up north of Fort Collins, about 2 hours north of Boulder. So it's still going. And, of course, now with the Sakyong having been called out on his sexual misdeeds, that whole thing is, you know, in terrible trouble, falling apart. And you heard about Dharma.
Really?
You heard about Dharma Ocean here, have you?
Dharma Ocean?
Yeah.
What? Tell me.
Well, Dharma Ocean was founded by Reggie Ray, who was a contemporaneous...
Oh, yeah, yeah. I've been there.
Yeah.
I've been there, yeah.
Well, that's completely folded now.
Oh, really?
Some people...
What happened to him?
The inner circle of his scene finally had enough of his bullshit, his meanness, his lack of compassion, his harmfulness to other people, how he handled the inner circle, that they finally went public, just like they did with Sogyal Rinpoche, just like they did with, I don't know, some other teachers, but Reggie Ray, they put out a public notice. The board, when the board of directors found out about it, they all resigned, and Dharma Ocean collapsed. It just happened less than a year ago. It's very sudden.
Wow.
It's gone. Wow. It's totally gone. These different outgrowths of students of various teachers and the teachers themselves, it's been a dominoes falling one after the other. I've been following it because I have this friend in Ireland who keeps track of it, and he sends me all the news. It's amazing how many have fallen. So anyway, that's the downside.
Well, I don't know if that's a downside. I don't see it as a downside. I see it as healthy.
Well, yeah, healthy, of course. But the downside is what was exposed. Talk about my disappointment with Zen students that are cold. They took down Baker Roshi also, was one of the first ones to go. I can see your point, of course.
Well, you know, I love staying at his place in Germany, and I love visiting Crestone. I mean, they're still going. I mean, it's not, in America, it's not a big group like the Zen Center was, but, you know, he bounced back. I love staying in Crestone there. I like visiting you, but Germany is much more vibrant.
Really?
Germany is really going good, and I feel really comfortable there. It's really a no-nonsense. It's what I call very low on the cult meter.
Uh-huh.
Really very comfortable being there. People are real no-nonsense.
Did you say low on
really the... Really evolved quite well. Low on the cult meter.
Like a low on the cult meter. Oh, I see. Yeah.
CULT. All groups have a reading on the cult meter.
Yeah, right.
And it goes up and down. So there's various adjustments. Sometimes, you know, they'll get rid of the founder. That's called when the founder gets founder's disease. I heard that. Well.
That's a great one.
And, a lot of times the founders readjust and come back. And then, you know, the communities get into other problems, like sometimes they become too bureaucratic. And religious groups, communities, institutions always have to be readjusting. When Buddha talked about the three ages of the Dharma, the age of the true law, the decline of the law, and the destruction of the law, like the way Dogen interpreted it was, it's, you know, don't think of it in historical terms, more of a I can't really say exactly how Dogen saw it, but you know, he saw it outside of the normal literal time scale as being something that's always happening. Buddhism and groups and people, they're subject to birth and disease, old age, death, and greed, hate, and delusion.
Sure, great.
You know, it's like Christians say, we are all sinners. That's the same sort of thing.
That's what?
I said, that's the same sort of thing. We are all sinners. That just means we all make mistakes. That's all that means.
Yeah. Well, kind of a negative view of the human spirit.
Well, no, it's one side. It's looking at it that way.
Actually, it's in Buddhism, you know, the same. Ego, called ego.
Pardon?
In Buddhism, it's the same. You're right. It is.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's called ego. I was thinking today we could have an ego quotient, just like you have a cult index. I think we should have an ego quotient. You have an IQ, then you have which is intelligence quotient, then you have an EQ, which is emotional quotient, which Daniel promoted that.
Daniel Goleman.
Yeah, Goleman, yeah, promoted that EQ. So now we have an ego quotient. Like, where are you on the ego quotient scale? Are you egoless yet, or what? You know, like that.
Yeah, hard to say. My feeling about problems with teachers and sometimes groups have gone way overboard is that, you know, people are responsible for themselves, and it really doesn't matter what problems or lack of understanding other people have. The only person whose understanding each of us can really deal with is our own. It's just normal for there to be, you know, things crashing and breaking all around you. That's what I think. Doesn't bother me much.
Well, don't the Zen people always say everything breaks?
I don't know if I've ever heard it said quite that way, but that's good. Yeah, that's good.
Some Zen masters quoted by saying that.
And it sounds like a Bob Dylan song. Everything's broken, I think. Yeah.
Hey, I have a question. How do you I wrote a poem the other day, or a couple of years ago, I think. I just found it the other day. It has the word raksu in it, and I don't know how to spell it. How do you spell raksu?
R-A-K-U-S-U.
I'll send you this poem, actually, that I wrote 2 years ago. I just found it, and I typed it up. Really nice. It has the word raksu in it.
Yeah.
Rakusu. Okay, got that.
They swallow the U, raksu.
They what?
They swallow the U, the middle U.
Oh, I see.
Raksu.
Yeah, raksu. But I just want to know how to spell it for the page. So, you know what? I just want to, in the interest of wrapping this up, it's been really great talking with you, by the way.
Yeah, great.
Yeah, and so I wanted to just say that I'm doing yoga here at home. I've taken yoga classes for the last 10 years off and on, good teachers. But now I do it. Now I decided to do it just at home on my own discipline. And yoga, hatha yoga, nothing too strenuous, but a full hour of asanas and then the laying down thing at the end. But what I wanted to say, in addition to that, I sit most mornings for an hour, and I don't really start to get sort of enlightened, you might say, until after 40 minutes. It takes me that long to settle. And then it's just from there to 60 minutes, it's just like pure Dzogchen. It's like pure, like the breath is there, but it's just all space. Any thoughts come, they just come and go. It's just like the ideal how it's described.
Yeah.
But I want to say to you that with all the practice and learning I've done with Tibetan teachings, the sitting that I do is no different than what we did at Tassajara.
Mm.
Just sitting. That's all it is. That's all I do. I don't do visualizations anymore. Sometimes I do Tonglen, you know, giving and taking and compassion exercises, but it's mostly the meat of it is just sitting, just like Suzuki Ryu said, just sit. So that's what I've been doing. Just wanted you to know that, wrap it up like
that's
that.
That's great. That is a great wrap up. That is great and very inspiring, the whole thing. That's really good. Okay, well.
Okay. Well, this has been a great fit.
Very good. Very good. Very inspiring.
I'm glad. Okay. Well, thanks for calling. I've enjoyed it a lot.
Yeah. Yeah, me too. Terrific. Okay. Take care.
Take good care and be safe.
Yeah, you too.
Okay, bye-bye. Man. Take care. Bye-bye.
That concludes our chat with Paul Shippey. However, we are not through with Paul yet. You remember that poem? He said he'd come across and he wanted to know how to spell the word raksu, rakusu. And he said he'd send it. Well, he did send it. Oh, just let me tell you what a raksu is first. It's a rectangular piece of cloth that hangs with straps around your neck. And it's a miniature version of the robe of ordination. It's, you know, Christians use stuff like that, like it looks like a big wide ribbon around their neck hanging down. Actually, Japan, they have quasi-raksus that do the same thing. As a matter of fact, the first raksus Suzuki gave out at Sokoji in 1962 were like that, I believe. Or at least there were people back then who had them. I'm not sure. I think so. Anyway, that's not important. I'm now going to read that poem because he did send it. October 27th, 2019, 11:15 a.m. My mornings are spent loving life. Sometimes the riches of emptiness arises in meditation. I notice my raksu is covered with dust. Hatha yoga is postponed so I can write these lines. Joanna Macy is on my mind with her hard-driving love of life. The morning sun penetrates deep inside my room as winter comes on. My father, R.I.P., was always threatened by my youthful exuberance. He thought it had no place in the serious business of life. He tried to shut it down, and that brought on my forceful nature. What is our true nature? Armies of Tibetan and Zen monks have dived deep into the mystery and found the secret in sustained meditation. This mystery is neither known nor sought in Western culture. Our cultural DNA was stamped, approved, and codified by René Descartes. He pronounced the body dead, or ignored and froze the psyche. In 300 years of materialist pursuits. Nowadays, we fight back, crawl back with hatha yoga, meditation, and gather the flowers of compassion, once again, from the sorry ashes of civilization. You can meet Paul Shippey again on Tuesday's podcast, if all goes according to plan, because I took out of this conversation the part where we talked about Bali, and he's been to Bali too. So I'll include that in the Life in Bali part that I start the Tuesday podcasts with. So this is DC Bhubha of Cuke Archives and Cuke Audio, wishing you a grand awakening.